So tranquility is this month's topic. So tranquility is an interesting word. We'll talk about it in the context of these, the transcendental origination. We'll talk about it in some other ways tonight. But it's such an important word in our practice. I think many of us are drawn to meditation because of this word. We see images, like the Kuan Yin or the Buddha. They seem so tranquil in the middle of life. And there's this thing we're drawn toward. Remember years ago, probably over 20 years ago, I was at the U District Fair, Street Fair. And, if you've ever gone to that, there's just thousands and thousands of people just filling the streets. And there's a couple people sitting just meditating right on the sidewalk there. And it's like, okay, well, I don't know what they were doing, if they're promoting their tradition or just wanting to practice and be in the midst of that. And we're quite a messenger of this little point of tranquility and all this bustle, all this energy of the street fair. So I think many of us are drawn to practice because of that. We want to have that sense of tranquility. And yet we also kind of have a love-hate relationship with it too, because if things are always tranquil, we get a little bored, I think, if we're honest. We want something more exciting. We want the street fair with all its bells and whistles, all its excitement. So tranquility is sometimes a acquired taste, to actually allow ourselves to be still, to be in the midst of the quiet and allowing that to sink in. Some of the opposite words of tranquility are unrest, turmoil, bustle, commotion, hubbub, pandemonium, uproar, noise, hurly-burly, and quietness. So, and this is also a point of frustration sometimes. We go to practice and we think, why am I not feeling that sense of stillness, that sense of inner tranquility? Because those two people sitting in the U District so many years ago, they looked tranquil, but who knows how tranquil they really were. As a meditation teacher, when I teach retreats, often people look at the fellow retreatants and think, well, that person's really got it together. They're sitting, they're practicing so deeply, so stillly. And then as a teacher, I get to hear how much stuff is going on in their minds. And of course, we tend to project that everyone else is doing this so well. I'm the only one with a busy mind that won't shut up. Right? So part of it is how do we work with it in a skillful way? Now, tranquility comes in different forms, but particularly in this context of this year-long exploration of transcendental dependent origination. I want to talk about it from that perspective for a moment. What comes before this part of the cycle, what comes after it? Because in a lot of ways, it is considered something that's progressive, that each stage leads to another. We can also look at them as a standalone entities, each in themselves. So tranquility first starts with this sense of faith. I mean, actually not tranquility, but transcendental origination starts as this sense of faith, I should say. Faith that there is some other choice other than my normal endless pattern of suffering, my endless pattern of feeling my heart broken and feeling this grip of wanting and not wanting, this sense of me who's so gripped by disappointment, by hopes, by fears, that there's maybe some other way of practicing. So there's a whole other cycle that we'll touch on called transcendental dependent origination, which actually describes in a lot of detail how this process of selfing arises, how we take form, and how we create this sense of self, which leads to suffering. Now, transcendental origination starts with that suffering, but instead of going into more suffering, it goes into this place, this direction toward freedom. And that starts with that quality of faith, this quality that there is a different possibility. That's the first link of this cycle. The next one comes into happiness. So happiness is this sense, actually not happiness, I'm sorry, joy is next. Happiness is next month. Joy is this quality of this kind of release, like maybe I've gotten out of this prison of my suffering. There's this possibility, there's this excitement that comes from that. And that often moves into the last month's topic, which is sometimes called rapture, or P-I-T-I, pity. Not pity, but pity. Not pity, but it's what's that?
Pity.
Yes, pity. Thank you. And that process is, there's this upwelling of energy sometimes. Sometimes we're meditating, we feel this excitement in our bodies, this energy is really intense, it's hard to contain. Sometimes there's just this upwelling of energy. And it's almost like all the energy that went into managing our suffering is freed up, and it has to process through our bodies and our minds. And this shows up in certain ways as a meditator, sometimes it shows up in different ways of our life. But if we just stayed at that level, we would kind of get overwhelmed by it. So that's where tranquility comes in. This rebalancing of our energy. This rebalancing of that intensity to more of this quiet, abiding relationship to this moment. To the stillness of this moment. The quiet of this moment. So from that, that becomes this beautiful precursor to happiness, which will be June's topic. So happiness is outside of conditions. So we have to really retranslate this in our minds, you know, in our, is it the Bill of Rights, the pursuit of happiness? You know, we have to retranslate, what does happiness really mean that's outside of conditions? Because usually we're happy if we have success, we have wealth, we have happy relationships, we have all of these situations and conditions, possessions, roles. But happiness that we're talking about from the Buddhist perspective is happiness which is outside of all those conditions, that's not dependent upon those conditions. So this is a really key piece. Because if we're dependent upon conditions, those will change. They will alter. We may be praised one day and then blamed the next. We may gain something and lose it the next day. And so then this moves in from happiness into concentration, which is an interesting way of approaching concentration, because usually we think, I've got to really focus. Concentration is this capacity of the mind to be really steady, to be unwavering, to be collected, right? And often concentration, we use it through our will. But this cycle of transcendental dependent origination actually goes into it from a place of happiness, a brightness of mind. That allows our minds to relax into stillness, into concentration. That concentration in itself has benefits, but really what it does, it allows us to see more clearly. And that goes into the last few stages, which is seeing the nature of how things are, the disillusionment that comes from that, and finally the liberation, right? So by December, we should all be fully enlightened, right? So just seeing how tranquility is part of this, the context of this list. It's, you know, it can be all by itself, but also it's important to see how it comes forth. Now, particularly with some of the kind of the downfalls that comes from tranquility. So tranquility sometimes can be something that we really seek after because it feels good. It feels good to have that respite from our busyness of our minds, from our heartache, from the stress of our lives in the world. And this is a great benefit to have that respite. But sometimes we long for it. We want it to come back. When I teach retreats and someone talks about the last retreat was so magical, was so peaceful, there's so much ease, I can't wait to do that again. And I'm like, okay, that's probably not how this retreat's going to go for you. Because that very sense of wanting it, that sense of longing, sets up this tension. It just sets up this distance between what is and what you want it to be. Right? Our tranquility almost comes of its own accord. It comes from a release, a letting go. Now, I just mentioned that transcendental dependent origination is kind of in a contrast to dependent origination, which is this cycle of how we set up the mechanism. It's almost like there's this whole, like a trap or a thing that's set up that we drop in some sense data, some point of contact, and we create this sense of self from it, right? It doesn't happen arbitrarily. It doesn't happen out of nowhere. It happens based on our past histories, our memories, our conditioning, to use the Buddhist word. It happens based on how we've acted in the past, tends to act us in the future. You know, example I sometimes use is just this conditioning that we do. Like if I had for a while I had this tendency after a day long or something, I wanted something sweet. And so then I would start to feel the end of the day long is like, okay, it's time to get something sweet. That past history, past choices, set up this urge to become a certain person who is seeking something sweet. And that's what would happen, right? So this is how this whole mechanism continues. So how this fits into tranquility is that we have this moment of tranquility. Maybe we fall into it on a retreat. Maybe there's a time of practice. We just feel that steadiness of attention, that quality of nothing needs to be changed or altered in this moment. Our minds kind of relax into this field of stillness, this field of ease, this field of, there's a quality of contentment. Nothing needs to be altered. There's an inherent perfection in this moment, right? So we experience that, and our minds say, I want more of that. I want to go back to that, right? And so that becomes this process of the person who wants to become something, to become a tranquil person. So we've moved from transcendental origination back to dependent origination. We've moved from moving away from suffering into absolute freedom into back into the cycle of suffering. And this is one of those little pitfalls that we fall into as meditators, that we practice, we have these beautiful experiences, we study, we hear talks, and they set up things that we want to achieve for ourselves. And so then we have to have discernment. Is this a sense of heartfelt yearning, a sense of moving toward something with discernment, with clarity? Or is there a sense of lack that's driving that? Or is there a sense of maybe being proud? It's like, my last meditation was pretty tranquil. How was yours? You know, and kind of a sense of comparison and coming up with a rating system or something like that. So tranquility, the reason I mention that is that it's really, especially in this context, it's really an opposition or it's a different pathway toward not becoming something, not becoming a person who's a great meditator, not to become someone who's even enlightened. Right? So it's a paradox, right? We think, okay, enlightenment sounds pretty good. It's my bucket list, right? I want to check that off my bucket list. So I'm going to try to do everything I can to do that. And yet if we start to practice with any sincerity, we realize that very impulse pushes it away. And tranquility is one of those experiences which can set up that distance, right? So it can be very subtle. It's an unconscious process that comes up, that we're really setting up that sense of self who's wanting something. There's a sense of lack that's coming from that. So often we experience tranquility, and it's almost like we're just in a very innocent way of living it, experiencing it. We fall into it. There's a sense of stillness. There's a sense of wonder with it. There's a sense of deep ease that nothing needs to be changed. And then our minds say, okay, more of that. That was a good meditation. I want to have that. So I always encourage us not to think in terms of this was a good meditation or that was a bad meditation, but just what was the meditation like? Was I able to actually meet it? Was I able to meet this moment? Right? Because if you judge your meditation by how it feels, you're going to have some frustration, right? But if you say, it doesn't matter how I feel, each moment, each day I'm going to practice. I'm going to open to this breath, this sensation. I'm going to open to this nature of self. Sometimes I'm going to be exhausted, sometimes racked with fear and grief. Other times there's going to be a sense of stillness and quiet and joy. By meeting each of those experiences, I'm starting to learn something which is outside of that, that actually becomes this gateway back into tranquility, into this place of stillness. So I'd like to now talk about how do we cultivate tranquility. So, you know, with the context that tranquility is part of transcendental origination, it's about deep liberation of the heart and mind, noticing how we go into that sense of wanting. But at the same time, it's really a helpful thing to cultivate. I think most of us probably need more tranquility in our lives, including myself. You know, and tranquility is interesting because sometimes we long to go to certain places that induce that tranquility. Go to, you know, a tropical paradise or go on vacation so I can be away from things, right? And yet we can bring ourselves with ourselves. There was an SNL skit where there was like a travel advertisement, but they're saying, just remember that you're going to still be you on your vacation. You're going to still carry you with, you know, if you're lonely here, you're going to be lonely there. You know, so you can't escape that. And so that's how we have to sometimes use the external to help us recover that, to recognize it. I think that's where we're often drawn to things like Japanese gardens or being in the beauty of nature, seeing a still lake. Because it invites that quality of stillness into ourselves. The external teaches that. And it's very powerful. And it doesn't have to be super profound or exotic. You can just look out right now and see if you can see the nature, some glimpse of nature. There can be a quality of that tranquility in it. Because the tree is not having a lot of worry, right? It's not stressed out about life. It's simply there. It's simply being there. And that can teach us something very profound about that access point. So tranquility, there's this inner quality, there's this external quality. And we can have this, be in a tranquil situation or environment and feel very untranquil inside. This busyness of the mind and the heart. So that's where the meditation comes in. So tranquility can be both induced or come forth, let's say, from meditation practice, also come forth from wisdom practice. So let's touch on those two for a moment. So meditation practice, in some ways, I sometimes think of it as we're kind of like these springs that have been compressed and twisted. So we're under a lot of tension, you know, through our work. Our relationships, you know, looking at the news, looking at the world situation. There's a lot of things that are very stressful. Right? We have very personal distresses. We have stresses as a society, as a nation, as a world. The future is uncertain. What's going to happen with climate change? And we have all that tension, and we start to practice, and that tension starts to unload from us. And that's not always a pleasant experience. It's not always a pretty experience. You know, sometimes it takes the form of the hindrances popping up, like the intro class. We just talked about the hindrances last week. And these patterns start to show up of restlessness and worry, of wanting and not wanting. You know, our bodies sometimes ache. And sometimes that's quite a turbulent process. Right? You can see it maybe in your daily practice. You sit and there's kind of a lot of busyness. And maybe your mind starts to quiet down after a bit, maybe after 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And there's this contact of quiet. And that's that tension pattern unloading. On the like a retreat environment, we see that even more clearly because we really take everyone's distractions away and all their responsibilities away. We ask them to give their phones up. And so they're just with themselves. And with yourself, then you start to feel that tension pattern unload in a more deep way. And sometimes you go through that kind of rapture, that piti section, where you kind of get that quality of excess energy. And then there's tranquility. And there's a moment of stillness or that kind of falling into that quiet. And often we've recognized that because there's nothing needs to really be changed in this present moment. There's an inherent perfection, and I'm okay with it. Part of it, I've let go of some of my patterns of control, of comparison, of judgment, of fixing. There's just a letting a sense of abiding happen. And that's one of the reasons we emphasize the technique in that way, not to look at it as something to fix about yourselves or to judge about yourselves or to compare yourselves to others, but just to see yourself just how you are. Because that's the fastest route into starting to just let the moment be how it is. When the moment's just how it is, tranquility is just a natural byproduct of that. And so next time you find yourself kind of struggling, whether it's in a meditation practice or just in life, ask yourself, what am I not allowing in this moment? What's the real rub in this moment? And sometimes it's a simple acknowledgement of that and saying, okay, maybe there's nothing I can change about this moment. And there's an easing, a sense of relaxing, a softening into how the moment actually is. So meditation practice can create this quality of tranquility. You come into a hall. I remember my early days at Seattle Insight, sometimes I have to come in a little late to the sit. And I would come in and the hall just felt like this field of stillness, this field of quiet. And be entering that field so that each person's practice helped me regain that quality of stillness. And that's the power of sitting together, whether you're here in person or online, that you start to, kind of like you start to resonate with that same quality of tranquility, the same quality of stillness. Now, sometimes that tranquility can be a little fragile, right? It can feel very still, and then someone makes a sound or some event happens, and then everything gets shattered. And that's a really interesting point to pay attention to in our lives, in our practice. Because how stable is that quality of tranquility? You know, is it dependent upon the conditions being just right internally and externally? Or can it have some sense of durability, some sense of resilience? You know, I appreciate those two young people sitting on the Ave there so many years ago, you know, sitting in the midst of all this noise. You know, try sitting in the midst of the mall or midst of some activity that's really busy, lots of things going on. See if there isn't some access point to that tranquility that's not so dependent upon the external circumstance. Something arises, we feel that, okay, I don't like that, I'm reactive to it. That's the point, that's the time to practice. Learning to practice with it, learning to open to it, to see your reaction, but not to buy into that reaction, that allows it to start to dissipate. And so then you gain this greater stability in the future of how you meet this moment. And we had a call the paramedics a few days ago, a couple weeks ago. And, you know, the person had some issues coming up, turned out to be fine, you know, so, but we wanted to make sure. But can you still practice in the midst of a big fire truck sitting out there and all these tall firefighters and paramedics marching through? You know, the practice doesn't have to be disturbed by that. You know, so practice with, see how that is in your life, in those disturbances. So I also said tranquility can come from wisdom. Okay, and this is kind of this link into conditions not being dependent upon whether you have tranquility or not. Okay, so wisdom starts to bring that quality of understanding or of stillness to this moment. What I mean by that is tranquility found in thought? You know, can you think about it? When you're worried about something, do you find tranquility there? When you're fantasizing about something, is tranquility there? You know, when there's a sense of wanting to describe something or engage with it, there's often tranquility actually goes further away. But when we're able to just quiet down and be still, we allow our thoughts to recede to the background, the foreground being this present moment, that's where tranquility lies. So we start to realize through wisdom that tranquility is certainly supported by external circumstances, supported by how we practice, but it's not dependent upon that. Ultimately, it's inside ourselves. It's in how we relate to this moment, moment by moment. So tranquility, this is coming from the homework or the reflection for this week. So where is tranquility found? You know, where actually is it? You know, is it a place? And you know, we talk about like that tranquil lake, that tranquil Zen garden or Japanese garden. There's, and it's true, if it's really arranged artfully or if there's a quality of nature coming forth in a vibrant way, tranquility is kind of just emanating from that area, right? And we can use that to teach ourselves. Is it external? Is it internal? But once we start to sense or feel that vibration, then ideally that teaches us the right note or the right flavor. So how can I find that outside of conditions, outside of the situation? What's the absence of tranquility? You know, is it that siren going by? Or is the tranquility really not affected by that? You know, the tranquility when we get caught in an argument or we're distressed by something we're reading on the news or we have a health crisis. And yet tranquility is almost like it's waiting there all along for us just to tap back into, to recognize it, to call it forth. Apparently the Tibetan Buddhist sometimes use that technique when we have this maybe an insight or a sense of deep connection with something, like let's say something tranquil, we can recall where we were when that happened. Recall that beautiful lake. Recall that quality of stillness when it was so palpable, it was so easy to access. And that helps us re-access it to this present moment. So it's a way of using our memory to say, okay, how is this moment actually also contain tranquility? What is released to allow tranquility to arise? What is released? Because is tranquility something that you can manufacture or create through a lot of effort and will? I mean, sometimes I feel that myself. I like, okay, I get all my chores done, then I can finally relax. You know, until that chore's not done, I can't relax. I can't relax into the beauty of my backyard and seeing the sunset. And yet that's a choice that I'm making. That's a choice I'm making that I have to eat my peas before I can have my dessert or something like that. But yet, practitioners, we start to learn that that's a fallacy. It's that condition we've imposed. What if I can just pause for a moment, connect with that sense of tranquility? What if I can bring that into these patterns that seem so compelling of control, of fixing, of comparing? And see how that's tranquility actually informs something about those. Is tranquility found in thoughts and in thinking? You know, can we, when we're really minds obsessed, when we're worried or fantasizing, where does tranquility lie? And finally, can you take ownership of tranquility? Can you actually claim that as I and me and mine? Now, is it something that's lacking in me that I need to gain? Right? So we start to feel that this is a very human nature. I mean, this is very natural to have that because this feels very good. It feels very pleasant. It feels deeply nourishing to have those moments of tranquility. And yet the trap is that when we start to see it as outside of ourselves, that's when we're going back into that cycle of suffering, of dependent origination, not transcendental origination. And so release it. Let it come when it comes. Let it go when it goes. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle, and then we'll see if you have anything you'd like to ask or share around this topic or anything else about the Dharma. As we sit together, we can use sound as a teacher of tranquility. As the sounds in the room, people shifting, the heat pumps, sounds of traffic. And each of those sounds, as they arise, it can be seen as a problem. there's something that shouldn't be here that gets in the way, and how that moves us away from tranquility. Or we could make peace with the fact that sound is here. Allow the sound to have its own expression, its own life. And tranquility arises of its own accord. All right, so we have some time now to kind of explore this topic more through your questions or your sharing. And those online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. We can unmute you so you can hear in the room. And here in the room, if you could raise your physical hand. And Brayden, do you want someone to do the mic for you? Okay, thanks, Jisley. Go ahead, Nina.
Can you speak a little bit about or speak to tranquility and pain? Like a person in pain?
Yeah, so tranquility in relationship to pain or kind of a... Let's see, is there someone online? Make sure you're muted if you're not speaking. Yeah, so this is really an important piece there, that sense of pain, because it often feels like it's in opposition. Like if I wasn't in pain, then I would finally feel that sense of tranquility. Right, so there's my personal pain or my physical pain or someone else's suffering. And yet, this is such an important place to practice with. So sometimes it's a practical thing of how do we kind of regain that capacity of mindfulness to actually open to pain. Because pain is one of those things we start to turn toward and open to. And sometimes it starts to make our mindfulness actually becomes tight and brittle. Like we're paying attention, but we're kind of fighting it at the same time. It's like, because it's painful. It's like we don't like it, right? So learning how to regain that quality of softness, that quality of receptivity, you can often do that by shifting to something outside of the pain to rebalance. Maybe you know something external like the beauty of the sunset or the tree, or maybe another part of the body. Till the mindfulness, you can sense it starts to shift. You often feel the physiological, maybe I take a deeper breath, my body relaxes. Then I go and touch the pain a little bit, but bringing that quality of curiosity. So part of it is the technique of how we open to that, right? And so that sense of curiosity, that rebalancing of our attention, there's a sense of, whenever I talk about it, I kind of stretch it to fit all of, as much of Dharma as I can. I'm finding myself doing that with tranquility. But tranquility has that, it starts to come forth kind of around the edges. There's the pain, but there's also the part of us which is observing the pain. It's also is outside of the pain. It's also aware of what's right in the moment, what's comfortable or pleasant in the moment, in a kind of an equal way. So that balance of attention allows a quality of tranquility to come. It's also helpful to see, to sometimes expand the container. So shifting like the focal points, or our mindfulness relaxes, becomes more steady as part of this. But also we can just almost literally shift away from this personalness of it. This is where I sometimes think of the personal and the impersonal, the universal and the personal are so helpful hand in hand. Because if we have that personal pain, if it's just me who's having this pain, my world becomes really quite small, becomes overwhelming. But if I start to recognize, well, other people have the same kind of pain that I'm having. Other people have the same loss, the same grief. And I start to reflect on that, then it's suddenly it's part of this human condition. It's not just me who's carrying this, me who's experiencing it. So I've expanded this container. I did this around death and dying. I was feeling this sense of overwhelmed by the, you know, anticipation of my own death and the death of my loved ones. And as part of an exercise in a class, I went to a graveyard and looked at all the gravestones and reflected on all the sadness, all the sorrow that I'm feeling, that all these people also felt. These stones lost, the stones, the people representing by those stones, the loss. And seeing how that kind of starts shifting it from this personal pain to this universal pain. and then expanding throughout the world, seeing all the people who've ever died, all the people who have lost, grieve for those losses throughout time. You start to get a sense of, when they talk about Kuan Yin, hearing, you know, the endless cries of the whole world and the endless sorrows of the whole world, right? So with personal pain, others' pain, suffering, part of it's rebalancing our attention, expanding it, bringing a quality of compassion to it, and seeing if tranquility isn't part of what arises with that. When there's a part of like, okay, something in me, some aspect, even if it's a small aspect, is still with it, is quiet with it, is at peace with it, then that's a little bit of tranquility. And it's amazing how just a little bit is sometimes enough. Thank you, Nina. All right, we'll get to you next. Yeah, go ahead.
So one of the things that I'm hearing, that I'm kind of hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, is, sounds like tranquility is like accepting the life of the moment just as it is and not trying to fight with reality. And it sounds a lot to me like equanimity. And I guess I'm wondering whether there are any distinctions there between tranquility and equanimity, the overlap.
Yeah, so the relationship between tranquility and equanimity and how they overlap and interrelate. Yeah, that's, I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're absolutely right that at least the way I'm conveying it right now, there is a lot of commonality between that. Equanimity is this equally near all things. There's a sense of balance of attention. Tranquility is, I would in some ways say that, like, equanimity is more of this relational way of being with, like the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. So you have metta, you have compassion, you have sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So it's kind of this kind of active relationship. You can say tranquility is almost this feel that's holding all of it. It's okay, there's this, and then maybe that's where it comes in with compassion. Tranquility can be this supporting factor that allows us to allow compassion to come forth, to allow equanimity to come forth. You know, and it's kind of outside of relationships, but yet it still includes relationships, is what comes to mind right now around it.
And that tranquility would kind of be like just accepting reality as the way that it is right now.
So here's an interesting thing to kind of play with. There's way, like, let's say I want to get to tranquility. One of the ways, gateways, is to allow the moment to be how it is, to see where I'm fighting this moment. And sometimes doing that, I have to spend some time kind of coming terms with, you know, I just don't really like this moment. I don't like how I am. I don't like this experience. So there's grief, there's sadness, owning maybe emotions I haven't felt. All those, sometimes that's a pathway to finally, okay, I'm allowing the moment to be just how it is. So then that allows tranquility to come up. So there's that, that's kind of the pathway to it. But there's also, from a place of tranquility, when we fall into it for whatever reason, could be meditation, could be just the sunset is just so beautiful, you're just shocked, speechless, and you're just shocked into the present moment. The moment, the usual stream of thoughts falls away, and you're just there. Then the expression, what makes sense from tranquility is allowing things to be how it is. So it's both the kind of a pathway to it. It's also an expression of tranquility. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But that, like, it's like a, are you saying that it's like a pathway to, like, accepting how things are is a pathway to it, but it's not, that's not tranquility itself?
Yes, yeah, I think so. It's at the end is the means is the end. Yeah, so yeah, think of it that way. It's like, okay, so I want to practice tranquility. I practice kind of moment by moment, making peace with this moment, allowing this moment to be. And sometimes that's just how you're seeing the world. Okay, yeah, there's nothing needs to be changed here. And tranquility is there right then.
So maybe equanimity is a path to tranquility.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yes. We could say probably equanimity is a tranquility, the path to equanimity. You can do both of those. All right, go ahead, Romley.
I actually forgot my question. I'm kind of struggling with being present, and then if there's too much pain or there's too much reactivity, and I'm not able to hold that reactivity.
Right.
Then if I intentionally change to going outside or looking outside at a tree, that's always helpful to me to be in nature, or changing my perspective to remembering a pleasant moment, that I've avoided. My concern is that I'm avoiding what I'm reacting to.
Yeah, so it's the question is whether we are using it skillfully, you know, like there's a skillful setting aside or a skillful distraction or skillful shifting, because we recognize trying to plow through it is going to be counterproductive or even sometimes harmful to us. You know, this is a great example around trauma, for example. If I'm sitting and I'm meditating and I start to have a trauma emerging, whether it's an old memory or a flashback or just a physiological piece, trying to stay in the middle of that is going to often make it more intense. It's going to kind of amplify it. Same thing, like if I'm having an argument, let's say, with my wife about something, and I know I'm just like stubborn, I don't want to give in, I don't want to hear her side, my heart's hardened, talking from that place isn't going to help things, right? So there's this wise recognition that, okay, I need to shift. Is that going to have a trauma response? I need to shift the way I'm practicing. So it's actually a wise avoidance, right? So
it is avoidance, though, but it's wise avoidance.
It's wise. It's like, it's like recognizing this is too hot. It's burning my hand. I need to wait till it cools down, or I get something insulated to pick it up. You know, so it's kind of that. So I guess the big thing is to notice, do I come back to it? Or do I always say, oh, not now? So if the habit is always to say, not now, I'm going to do it later, I don't want to deal with it, and I never come back to it, then that's the difference. I have someone I know, how do I say this without getting too detailed? We're talking about mortality, right? And this person did not want to have that conversation. Other people did. So it's like, okay, that's respect that. That's fine. But hopefully this person will come back to that at some point at their own pace, their own timing, but realize, okay, this is a charged thing, and that's not something I want to just bury and lock away. But I just make a note that at some point I need to come back to it. I need to open to it. Does that make sense?
And it's more skillful, and it's way more skillful than reacting from that pain.
Yes, yeah, if you have the choice and you have the opportunity, yes, it's more skillful. Because often our reactions aren't the smartest part of us, right? They're not the kindest part of us. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't say things in the wisest way. So if we can, wait till we cool down and come back. Just realizing there is that coming back, that circling back.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And, you know, if you feel like it's too much to come back to, then we gain the skills of how to come back to it. Maybe there's different ways of avenues of coming around to it. And it might take years. We have a lot of charges in this heart and mind. All right, go ahead, Emery.
Hi. Thanks so much for the talk, and I really love tranquility, and I really do, you know, I know that I want to experience it. And my question has to do with making life choices that support more tranquility. And I feel like there's at some point when you're maybe really, really enlightened or far along on the path, no matter what comes up in your life, you're able to have some tranquility around it. But I'm wondering about, you know, maybe when you're a newer practitioner or just a less advanced practitioner and trying to move along the path, and yet if your life is too busy or your circumstances are so stressful or you happen to be in a phase of life where there's just a lot of suffering or a lot of difficulty and busy, like it's not just, you know, it's like busy difficulty, like lots of things going on. So my question is, A, how do people progress when they're stuck in a lot of challenging circumstances? And B, is it skillful when you get the chance to say no and slow down and have fewer responsibilities and have fewer roles that you have to fulfill? Is it skillful to do less and to have a less complicated life so that you can move along the path more easily?
Okay.
In a few short sentences, please.
A and B there. First of all, I just want to also just say that it's sometimes having this sense of distance or, you know, how much, like, we project upon an enlightened person and how they're going to be in the world and how their lives are going to be, you know, they're going to be able to just kind of smoothly go through all kinds of crises and not have any issues. So that's kind of a projection of how their lives actually are. Because unfortunately, you know, you don't have to look too far to see people who are of deep realizations, enlightenment, and personally their lives can be a mess, right? They can have a lot of issues around, you know, boundaries and abuse of power and sexual misconduct. So there's this integration sometimes that's lacking. And sometimes enlightened people or teachers, their lives are kind of really sheltered. They don't have a lot of friction, you know, and so just saying, you know, like Ram Dass, I think, said that if you think you're enlightened, go spend time with your in-laws or something and see what comes up from that. You know, so part of it, like that distance sometimes makes it feel like, okay, I'm so far away, how can I possibly do this? So part I want to just say is like, kind of take away that piece there. Another teacher said that there's really, strictly speaking, there's not an enlightened people, it's enlightened actions, right? So there's enlightened actions. Now that changes it, right? That changes the whole conversation a little bit. Instead of like, okay, until I'm just such a mess, I'm not going to get enlightened until maybe 10 or 15 lifetimes if I'm lucky. You know, there's all this projection to the future, or maybe when my kids go to college, I don't know. But there's all this into the future piece. But like, okay, what about in this moment, can there be an enlightened moment, enlightened way of responding in this moment? So it's like taking all the idea of how you should be to just meeting this moment of this conflict with this child I'm working with, or this, one of my kids or my children I work with, or relationships, or this person on the other side of the political aisle. Can there be a little bit, can I be a little bit less reactive? Can I be a little bit more open and connected? You know, and notice how, again, I think we sometimes discount the power of the small things, the power of a little bit of a shift. Because there's a huge difference. I know, yeah, sometimes talk about conflicts with my wife. We have a very good relationship. But, you know, things happen sometimes. But if there's no space, if there's a hardness of heart, there's no avenue to have a conversation. But if there's a little bit of one in either one of us, then that opens the door. Okay, the same thing with all the complexity, all the difficulty, all the busyness of your life. Just see if there's a small way that I can be, maybe take one breath before I say something. You know, can I pause for just a little bit before I say? So try to downgrade the expectations of how enlightened you should be, and you know, there's going to be like flowers popping up after you walk through the hall or something like that. You know, this light comes down, rainbows and all that. Just try to think of it as just small little pieces there. And then the second part, part B, I give you full permission to have better, you know, boundaries and self-care and have less to do on your plate. And if it helps to have it, that's in the service of, I mean, just it's good self-care for us. But yes, yeah, if we're always kind of at our rope's end, it's hard to have that space. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and try to have as much as you can, make us, you know, say no, you know, maybe give less. Mm-hmm. You know, so many of us, you know, give so much a detriment for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Does that help at all, Emory?
Very helpful. I do remember in previous talks you've talked about that distance between like where I am now on a spiritual path and where I think I'm going, and to shorten that distance or take away that distance, that, you know, it's right here. Like we're right here, right
That's
now.
Right. Yeah.
So that reminds me of what you said, reminds me of that as well. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I think it's the Soto Zen perspective is that, you know, you're already the Buddha. You've already awakened. You know, it's uncovering what's already there.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, go ahead, Kathy, and then we'll see you back in the room. Okay. We'll go Kathy next, and we'll go Hoover's next. Do you need help unmuting, Kathy?
Yeah.
Oh, you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Okay. I can't find the meeting. Okay, thanks. I'm just pondering, I think my questions are rolled into what you said to Emory, but if tranquility is a, it's just all mixed, I'm kind of mixed up right now. If I sit down to sit, I have some, you know, I've been working with the nine bodies, and they have the way you learn to come into being present and be present in your body, all this stuff. So, but then when I sit, it's, well, every time it's different, but if tranquility is, I'm just confused about, like, if tranquility it sounds like a very desirable thing, but then if I sit down and want something desirable, that sounds like what you're talking about not doing. That sounds like a kind of a hindrance like in general with our sitting practice. Do you think that things just will happen? Things will come along, and then we recognize them, or do we go on a path of discovering tranquility?
A little of both. Yeah, so you can practice in a way that inclines us toward tranquility or, you know, equanimity or whatever we might be aiming for. But we hold it in a kind of in a light way, in a way that's not, we're not trying to make it happen. You know, but yeah, we can still practice in a way. Like, I think Joseph Goldstein, you know, gave one of his great humorous stories of being a child and growing carrots, like in one of those boxes. I think it was a box, you know, something, but he was growing the carrots, but he kept pulling them up to see if they were growing, right? So if he had just, you know, been patient, okay, there's soils here, the leaves are here, I'm watering it, there's sunshine is there, the conditions are there. I can just relax and trust that it will come when it will. So tranquility is a bit like that, that you can practice in a way. So, okay, I know if I'm all frantic, if I'm rehearsing what I need to do, I'm worried about something, tranquility is going to be further away. If I'm just connecting with the breath or doing all the preliminary stuff like you've learned in nine bodies to get prepared to practice, that helps support the conditions for the tranquility to arise. And when it arises, then the idea is to kind of get out of its way, let it kind of deepen. And in some ways, your question is really around wise effort. Remember back last year, wise effort is part of the Eightfold Path. Is how do you help unwholesome things not arise? And when they've arisen, how do you release them? How do you deal with the hindrances? How do you deal with all the distractions of the mind? And then things that are wholesome, let's say tranquility is wholesome, it arises. How do you kind of get out of its way so it can deepen? Yeah. A lot of it's trial and error, right? You start to learn like, oh, tranquility is here. This is really cool. I really like, oh, where did it go? You know.
When it arises, we can't catch it or hang on to it, right?
That's right. That's right. It's not yours to hang on to.
Okay.
There's not you who can hang on to it.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. All right, so go ahead.
Hey, Tim. So when we started the year, I was very curious about where the concept of selflessness being selfless would come in the process.
Yes.
And today it feels like it kind of starts now, and from maybe I misunderstood things, but it feels like tranquility is some part of a byproduct of starting to be a bit like selfless in a sense. Or at least maybe it helps. Or maybe I'm getting this very wrong, but I'd like to hear if there is something here or not. And then maybe selflessness is like, doesn't matter in this whole 12-step process. Maybe it just happens at the end, and there is not much to think about it across the whole step. And maybe I'll stop waiting for it.
Okay, so question is around selflessness or non-self. How does that fit in? Kind of waiting to see where is it going to pop up in this list of 12 things. In some ways, it's really embedded all the way through. In fact, it's the starter or the first is really this thing that starts the whole thing off. So again, contrast that with dependent origination, which is really this mechanism of how we create the sense of self, past memories, experiences, actions, primer senses. We form into the sense of self. Oh, this is great. This is terrible. I suffer. And then that reconditions that whole thing. The point of suffering, and then you go into, oh, maybe the sense of self doesn't have to actually be believed in. That's embedded in that faith. And we start to get excited by that. That's where that sense of joy comes in, and maybe the pity comes in, and then tranquility is, oh yeah, the sense of self is getting quiet. And we start to go into the happiness outside of conditions. Because when we talk about conditions and happiness, the sense of self is part of that. I'm the one who's happy if this is here. I'm the one who's unhappy if this isn't here. Right? So we start to realize maybe happiness doesn't have to go through this sense of me, the middleman of self. Right? And then we start to have concentration. We start to see more clearly. And then we actually start to see, oh, this... Because before, the sense of self is kind of bouncing along with all this, I think. But then we start to see things how they actually are. We realize, oh, this goes a lot more deeply than I thought. This is actually really deeply letting go of this perspective of self. And then disenchantment is, that's going to be interesting to get into to that one. And that's when we start to see the fertility of the sense of self and that wanting, how it just ties into that cycle. So it's really embedded all the way through. But you have to kind of pull it out a little bit. But just remember, the whole transcendental dependent origination is one of the journeys is is of non-self. That's embedded in, that's the whole premise of it. Yeah, and it's fine to be interested in it. It's fine to explore it, to look for it. Just realize that probably the sense of self is doing that exploration. Yeah, so eventually the sense of self, something else has to come forth to see it. Does that help?
Yeah.
All right, maybe one or two more. Yeah, go ahead, Ann.
Thanks, Tim. Hey, see if this question makes sense. How can you tell if you're experiencing tranquility or delusion?
Okay. So this is a good one, because delusion, let's say we talk about it from the hindrance of sloth and torpor. So sometimes you can have that hindrance be, or you're not quite aware that's there, but the mind, you're just kind of drifting along. You're kind of, there's a little bit of a vagueness of the breath, but you're kind of like maybe daydreaming a little bit, and you're kind of almost half asleep. It feels really pleasant. It can feel kind of tranquil, but you're not really awake and present. So that's the hindrance, gets a little sneaky that way, right? Well, in meditation and life in general, there's a sense of being aware, being present, right? So that's where the delusion, that's one way the delusion can come in. Kind of sneaky, the sneakiness around sloth and torpor can feel that sense of ease, but it's really, we're kind of a little disconnected and dulled out. Other times it can arise. Yeah, here's a good one. You can see how fragile it is, right? How reliant on situations and circumstances. Like, okay, everything's tranquil, it's really quiet, and then someone starts to play the radio, and you're like, no, then it's everything's shattered, right? So you can see that your tranquility was really conditioned, was based on the conditions. And sometimes there's a sense of holding on to the tranquility when that's not what's needed right now. Maybe right now is needed to be really lively and engaged and having that, what was there? They're hurly-burly. We need to, you know, that's the energy that's needed. And there's, so attachment comes up. So you often notice it when that tranquility is disturbed, what arises in response to that? Is there a sense of attachment, or a sense of, you know, outrage or friction with that longing for that tranquility? Then you can see that there's probably some delusion mixed in with that tranquility. Well, when it's maybe more of a, I hate to say pure, but it's a little bit like that when it's a more clear form of tranquility. It's like, okay, that's now this thing is arising. And tranquility is still actually there. It's just kind of a little bit more in the background. Does that help at all, or is that kind of confusing? Yeah, play with it. Take it for a drive and see for yourself. You know, because delusion's an interesting pairing around that. If you can see clearly, if there's a clear seeing, and that seeing and seeing is tranquil, you know, delusion is kind of in the background a bit. That's probably the key piece. If there's not the clear seeing, then maybe delusion or something else is happening. You're welcome. All right. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for the wonderful talk tonight. I appreciate it. I was wondering if you could point to maybe some suttas or some of the Buddha's words on tranquility that may help. I like reading the suttas and kind of going home and sitting with those. So if anything comes to mind that's helped you with tranquility.
Nothing is coming to mind right off the bat. Does anyone else... For Marie, you got your suttas, Jisli?
I was thinking of something else. So, what was the question?
Any, or Jisli, or Rachel, or anyone else, suttas that talk about tranquility? Yeah, so the Metta Sutta. Yeah.
The Luminous Mind Sutta. is, to me, a succinct summary of the Dhamma. I don't have it memorized right now, but it's very short. If you just Google it afterwards, the luminous mind.
Okay. Thank you for Marie.
The ones that come to mind are around the jhanas, and there's some just really helpful metaphors, like images. And so one is like, oh, there's a natural spring in a lake that fills up. And so I don't actually know what that one is called, but I know that there's like
there's different images of the different levels of jhana. So jhana, you know, concentration. So this list is kind of inclining us that direction. So yeah, those are all good resources. So the reason I call on those three people, so Jisli's doing the local or community Dharma program at Spirit Rock, as is Rachel, and for Marie is going through the residential teacher training program. So she's training to become a residential teacher. So put them on the spot. Thank you. All right. So I think we've come to our 9 o'clock hour. So thank you all for your engagement.